And we will move on to the next case for this morning, which is Campion Barrow & Associates against the City of Springfield. Mr. Rahm.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Brian Rahm. I represent the appellants in this case, Dr. Campion, Campion Barrow & Associates. This is a First Amendment retaliation case, which was dismissed on summary judgment. And the central issue in the case is whether there are enough facts in the record for this to go to a jury. The plaintiff, Dr. Campion, has presented, in our view, substantial evidence which would qualify and support a reasonable jury's decision in his favor for discrimination. Basically, what happened in the case was Dr. Campion, who's a psychologist, he's been a psychologist for over 30 years, specializes in police candidate screening and fitness for duty evaluations.
And counsel, I hate to interrupt, but we've all read the underlying facts. I guess my question is, what evidence do you have that shows that city council members were motivated by Dr. Campion's protected activity?
Well,
what real evidence do you have?
The evidence has to be looked at in a totality. It started out with an article which revealed that Dr. Campion was associated with the Illinois Family Institute, which is a conservative organization.
Right. So what evidence do you have that the city council members read it, that they discussed it, that it was – that's what I mean. What evidence do you have about their knowledge and their being in on this, quote, activity?
Well, Alderman McNeil was the first one to speak out in very direct and emphatic terms. When he heard about Dr. Campion's affiliation with this conservative group, he immediately contacted the mayor. And he said to the mayor, this guy's got to go. He's entitled to his conservative views, but we're entitled to change our reviewers. And he asked Mayor Davlin to set the wheels in motion to get rid of him. Alderman McNeil says that Mayor Davlin said, I'll take it under advisement. Mayor Davlin says, oh, he doesn't remember any such conversation. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't, but certainly that had nothing to do with actually setting the wheels in motion. But the fact is that Dr. Campion had been working for 15 years for the city, no problems. He had just had a good review in 2003. But after Alderman McNeil made those statements to Mayor Davlin, within 4 months they were looking for a new psychologist, and that was in August of 2004. By January of 2005, they had found a new psychologist, and by that spring they had terminated their relationship with Dr. Campion.
Now, can I just follow up on this?
Please.
In the depositions, though, I'm trying to get to what the city council members knew, because in their depositions, they talk about issues relating to people complaining about, you know, the reviews that he did and other things. They don't talk about this article and this other business, and I'm trying to get to, you know, I know the McNeil, what McNeil said, but everybody else said that Champion's personal views were not a factor in their vote to contract with Dietrich.
I would say that that's really an issue of fact, because there was a wild discrepancy between the aldermen. Alderman Smith said that he knew that McNeil wanted to get rid of Campion because of what he had said, and the rest of us, it wasn't a big deal.
But isn't that hearsay? I mean, I think what Judge Will, if you went down each alderman, and this may not even be the right way to do it, but suppose we just started there. You have McNeil. We all understand what McNeil was out there saying. But most of the rest of them, for differing reasons, either didn't read it or had no interest in it or otherwise were unaffected. And you can't rely on hearsay to defeat summary judgment.
I would take issue with that's hearsay if an alderman that's in the midst of it, like Alderman Bartolomucci, said that this whole issue with Dr. Campion caused the political stir. Well, the trial court said that's speculation.
Isn't it?
No, mm-hmm. I don't think so. Mm-hmm. If an alderman
What's the political stir?
It means there was political talk about it.
I have no idea what that means in concrete terms.
Well, let me put it this way. Alderman Yeager said that they had a meeting, a city council meeting, where this issue was discussed. And she says that, while the other ones say they don't remember and they didn't hear about it. There's wildly different testimony in that regard.
Say that? What page of...
All that Yeager heard was after the contract was approved, this is after it was approved, she heard McNeil discuss getting rid of Campion while the microphone was still on, and she said she told McNeil to be quiet because it was a lawsuit waiting to happen. That was after.
Well, Your Honor, in the record, the appendix at page 123 is the deposition testimony of Alderman Yeager. She says she has a recollection in the city council meeting where we were discussing Dr. Campion. And I remember somebody either amongst the council or among formal council members, someone in the audience spoke about Dr. Campion's involvement with the Center for Family or whatever. That was also reiterated by the HR director.
Does she say when that meeting happened, before, after the contract was changed?
She doesn't say... Yeah, well, the question was, do you remember discussing this issue, the issue of Dr. Campion's employment with the city, when this article came out, August 2004? It wasn't until the spring of 2005 that they actually
But we have
got
no date
him.
On when this meeting, alleged meeting that she's talking about there happened.
Well, I asked her at the deposition whether she remembered at the time that the article came out, which was August 2004, she says, yes, I have a recollection of this meeting. And I remember somebody talking about it in the meeting, Dr. Campion and his affiliation with IFI. She remembers that. And the HR director, Selinger, also remembers that there was a meeting. In the record at 362, he says, it seems like I remember that at a city council meeting where the Dusty Rhodes article was discussed and brought up.
Did you introduce records of the meetings? Minutes?
Yeah, there was nothing. It wasn't reflected in the meetings, which is not surprising, and which is part of the dilemma that the plaintiffs have in these kind of cases, which this court has observed. It's rare that you're going to get a direct admission by any council member that they did anything or knew anything about discrimination. We really do have to look at the circumstantial evidence in this case and put each piece together as a mosaic. We have a situation where Dr. Campion worked for 15 years, and it wasn't until this disclosure of his affiliation with a conservative group came out, and one of the aldermen contacted the mayor and demanded that he be removed. And the wheels started for his removal after that. Circumstantial evidence. I think that, excuse me, Your Honor, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted, while you're on that, the article was in, what, August of 04?
August of 2004, that's correct.
And then in December of 04, they renew his contract.
Well,
is that correct?
That's not correct. That is a gross mischaracterization.
Authorize additional expenditures under the contract, though, which in a sense says keep on working because they couldn't pay more than a certain amount without an ordinance being passed.
Correct. However, his contract started in June of 2000 and renewed automatically by its own terms every June.
But it was also terminable on 30 days' notice by either party. So if they really had wanted to get rid of him, they could have simply given the 30 days' notice and they would have been rid of him.
Well, certainly, but that would at the same time raise major red flags as to why they were getting rid of him at that particular time.
Now you're really speculating. And the fact is, if they wanted to get rid of him, they didn't have to keep him for a full year.
The reason I ask that is because at that time, that meeting, there's some record of that meeting, there was no discussion of whether or not this should go on. Is that...
We don't have any record of discussion at
no
that
one
meeting.
No one recollects that or there wasn't any discussion. How many articles did Rhodes write?
Three.
How many before the contract was switched?
Two.
There was a second one.
Yeah. There was partial disclosure. Last Straw was the last article after where she reported on what happened.
What was the date of the second one?
The second one was in May of 2005 or June.
But that's after the vote.
That was after. It was really the first one is
the
relevant one.
The only one before the vote then.
And can I just address the issue of the...
The first one, I mean, you could answer Judge Mannion's question. The first one was the only one before the vote, the August 2004 article.
That's correct.
Okay.
And really the one that sparked what actually happened here. The issue with the renewal of the contract, I think, is an important one because he was getting paid for work that he had already done. It wasn't like they were saying, well, we want him to stay on and we're going to authorize X amount more money. He had already done the work. In fact, that was the routine from 2000
on. He didn't do any new work in 2005 before he got fired?
No, he did work in 05.
Right. So it's not only the back money that he was owed that the December ordinance went to, but he continued to work in 05.
But they actually issued another ordinance to pay him for work that he had done in 05 after after Dr. Dietrich was hired.
Exactly. But my point is, they could have fired him. He was still doing work for them from January to when Dietrich was hired. And they continued to cut invoices on the work, obviously, that he needed to be paid for.
He continued to do work, but I think that the court has to look at the practicalities of getting rid of him. He's a police psychologist that did work for 15 years. You can't just get rid of him because it was ongoing work.
Police officers were being hired. But of course, the other thing that happens in 2003 is Mayor Davlin is elected. Mayor Davlin thinks that all this pre-employment psychological evaluation work is so much waste of time.
That's right. And then his advisors told him
there's nothing ideological about that. He's tarring the entire psychology profession, not particular members of it.
I don't think that that's dispositive of the issue here because...
I didn't say it was dispositive, but it's a fact that a couple of things that are important happened in 2003.
Correct. And when he looked into the matter, he was told that, number one, Dr. Campion is doing great work for the city. Number two, the city needs to employ psychologists to keep officers from being employed that should not be employed. And he didn't do anything after that. It wasn't until...
That's that advice. I understand.
It wasn't until the disclosure of his affiliation with IFI that the wheels of his removal rolled. And the consensus on the board was this is why it happened. It happened because of McNeil's comments. It happened because Edwards testified.
But that's not what everybody testified to in their deposition. And even this Bartolomucci, who you rely on, all he testified to was he believed the reason the city changed psychologists was because of the political climate. Like, there's no testimony by him saying that he heard aldermen say they wanted to get rid of him because of, you know, his affiliation. I mean, it's his belief. You know, he looks at the situation, says it's a political deal.
Well, but I think the opinions of aldermen that were there at the time are relevant.
But
and
opinions
admissible.
Are not admissible. That's the problem. Well, an opinion on what the motivation was as to the vote of the other aldermen is totally irrelevant. It may be interesting for you to know in your deposition that that's his belief, but that's not admissible in court.
If Alderman Bartolomucci says, I believe, as an alderman, that the reason why this happened was all the political pressure that was brought to bear because of this issue, I think that the jury can take note of that.
If the testimony gets to the jury, but what I'm telling you is his belief is not evidence. It's not admissible. So he can believe anything he wants, but it's not going to get before the jury. That's the problem.
Well, I think it depends what his belief is based on. If his belief is based on something...
No, it's opinion testimony. It's opinion testimony. It's not expert testimony. It's not just sort of opinion testimony that, like, you know, how fast was the car going? Was the person drunk or not? It's not that kind of opinion testimony, which based on someone's life experience one could testify to. It's just not... It's opinion testimony. It's irrelevant.
I would disagree, Your Honor.
And not admissible.
I take issue with that because I think that somebody in the position of firsthand knowledge, being on the board, being in the environment at that time, is in a position to say, this did cause a political stir. It's not an outsider. It's not somebody reading something about something that was said. It's somebody that's in the room.
Okay, we understand that that's your position. If you would like to save any of your time for rebuttal, now would be the time to do it.
Thank you.
All right. We'll hear from Mr. Anselman.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Jason Anselman. I represent the City of Springfield, Illinois. I think as the questions that have been asked indicate, this case essentially boils down to proof of motivation.
And I have a question for you, Mr. Anselman, which is how, in your view, this court should go about evaluating motivation of a multi-member body like the city council. Do you count heads? Do you look at objective evidence? Do you look at the ambient atmosphere, whether there was an atmosphere of political turmoil? What's the appropriate way?
Your Honor, I think that, first, in this case, regardless of how you look at it, there's evidence, and when viewed in a light most favorable, there is evidence that one out of 11 aldermen was impermissibly motivated. Any way you look at
it.
I'm sorry?
The 11th being the mayor?
The 11th being the mayor, who did have a vote and was a member of the legislative body, not just not only as an executive.
No, and given that 11, this is an emergency vote, right?
Yes.
So, really, he has to come up with four people to get what I guess you would call the significant block.
Well, at least four.
Well, four would tip it over to the top of the majority. That's all I'm looking at to see.
Right.
I haven't seen four, but it seems to me that would be at a minimum. He would have to show that four people had some bias similar to McNeil's.
Yes, Your Honor. Back to your question.
So, in other words, if he could show that there were four people like McNeil, then the eight necessary for the emergency passage wouldn't have been there.
Not to affect the change, Your Honor, but then the opposite of that isn't necessarily true either, that wouldn't eight be required to actually make the change? Wouldn't all eight have to be impermissibly motivated? I think there's a good argument in a 1983 case where we're looking at Monell that you ought to have, in a typical case, at least a majority, because what you're talking about is holding the city itself responsible. And when less than a majority cannot affect a change, then how do you hold the city responsible itself?
You don't have an emergency vote.
Right. I agree with that, Judge. But even in a typical case, if this wouldn't have been passed under the city's rules, it would have just went on a regular vote at the next meeting. But I think what we're really talking about is one decision by the city of Springfield. That is what's being attacked. And I think there's a good argument that in this particular case you'd need to show eight people were impermissibly motivated, but at a minimum, a majority of six. And
so just to be clear, your view is that if somehow we had evidence we could rely on that seven of the eight had the purest of motives and only one of them, you know, Alderman McNeil or somebody, was voting for constitutionally impermissible reasons, then the city couldn't be liable? I just want to make sure I understand your...
I think there's a good argument for that, Judge. I'm sorry.
That's your position, then, other than just... I like to tell people the fun part of being a judge is that you don't get to say, some say yes, some say no, I say maybe. You actually have to decide, and you do, too, right now.
Yes, I think you would need a number of aldermen. You'd need a minimum number that was required to affect the change. In this case... under the city's rules at this city council meeting, that number really would have been eight.
So if the city had put a statement of purpose in the ordinance to the effect of we don't want people with conservative views serving as psychologists, that would be enough. But no one's going to do that. So what short of that would satisfy the rule you're arguing for?
The city doesn't argue that you can't rely on circumstantial evidence, including reasonable inferences, but it has to be based on admissible evidence, as I think this court has recognized in some of the questions. I think one of the primary cases, Umbar, the Supreme Court case that said that independent contractors can be held liable, or the city can be held liable for independent contractors. That case, I think you had two out of three voting board members of that community in Kansas. And so there, I think there was circumstantial evidence that they were impermissibly motivated. But nevertheless, you have to have evidence. And here, again, there is evidence when viewed in a light most favorable to Campion that one alderman was impermissibly motivated.
Let me ask you on a different note, but, you know, I'm curious about this emergency passage procedure. Why did the city choose to use that procedure for the Dietrich ordinance and not just let it come up in the normal course?
Your Honor, I think that there is an ordinance fact sheet. I don't have the page number, but I think it's attached to the response to the motion for summary judgment filed by Campion is where I think it's in the record, but I'm 99% sure it's in the record. That suggests, and we have this in all the ordinance fact sheets, someone requests emergency passage, there needs to be a justification. And the justification on that fact sheet, I believe, is that there were some psychological exams that were coming up, and the city needed to get someone hired before the next city council meeting. And so It's not, as the testimony indicates from at least one alderman, and I think a couple, this is not an extraordinary procedure. It's used at every city council meeting.
Does the record show that? And if not, who would have had the burden? I was very curious to know whether it's just, as you say in your brief, a routine matter that there'll be a couple of emergency ordinances per meeting, or whether this is the first time in the last 10 years one has been used. It would mean something different, I think, if the latter were true.
Your Honor, I recall, I think, a couple times in the record. I did not sit through all the depositions, but I know the deposition that I did sit through, Alderman Tom Sellinger at the end, testified that it was used at every meeting, and even Alderman Smith, I think, is where you would find a discussion of emergency passage, although he has his opinions about when it is and isn't used. I think that there is evidence in his testimony that it's not that it wasn't ever used. Yes.
Okay.
I'm just looking at things a little bit hypothetically, but we all acknowledge that McNeil was definitely wanting to get rid of this fellow. It's been a long time, but one time I was a state senator, and when someone would come to me and say, look, this is really going to help me, I really appreciate your vote, and I didn't really care, you know, it wasn't a big deal to me, I would say, okay, you know, it's not that big a deal. And some sort of indicated here some that they didn't care or didn't really think about it. If, and I don't see it here, but if someone had said, well, you know, I did this because McNeil asked me to, it's important to him, and I didn't care, would that change the complexion of it as far as numbers and who voted for a reason not appropriate?
Well, I would liken that to the rubber stamp or cat's paw type theory, Your Honor, and I think that if we're talking about the world of impermissible motivation, you'd have to at least know at a minimum that his impermissible motivations. What were his motivations? Not just that he wanted to get a new psychologist, but if you're going to bind...
McNeil. No, McNeil was unequivocal. He wanted to get rid of him because he felt his religious beliefs and whatever association beliefs were impacting his decisions. And they've conceded that this is protected activity. That yes. might be challengeable, but as far as saying that's the reason... He's infiltrating his religious beliefs into his decisions and his evaluations. Therefore, I want to get rid of him. Okay, that's McNeil.
Yes.
Assuming someone knows that, may not agree with him, but said, yeah, that's McNeil. And McNeil says, hey, I really appreciate your help on this. I'll support you for something else.
Alderman Smith, for example, testified that if he didn't care about something, he might have just went along with the crowd. I think to bind the city of Springfield and to count Smith would also have to know the impermissible reasons, not just that McNeil wanted to get it done, right. but the reasons he wanted right. to get it done. And there's no evidence of that here.
Yeah, so even that's what I'm saying. If that, I say hypothetically because for whatever reason, good or bad, each person who was deposed carefully found some other reason than that. Of why they voted. So that's sort of the end of that.
Your Honors, if there are no further questions, we just ask that the summary judgment in favor of the city be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anselman. Anything further, Mr. Rao?
The court asked about the significant block test and how the votes of the Aldermen should be viewed. It's our position that the significant block test should not be used. The Seventh Circuit has not adopted that. This really should be a totality of circumstances test. And this court in U.S. versus Board of School Commissioners used the totality of circumstances test because, as I said, invidious discrimination may often be inferred from the totality of relevant events. And the events at that court in that case thought were relevant were the historical background of the decision, the sequence of events leading up to the decision, departures from normal procedural sequence.
But what in the record suggests that the use of the emergency procedure is such a departure if it's used at virtually every meeting for something?
Well, that doesn't necessarily answer the question. If it's used every time as a parliamentary trick to slip things through.
But why is it slip things through if you need a supermajority to pass it that way?
Well, according
and
to the
you have
alderman,
to have a basis stated on the sheet. I mean, that...
Well, let's look at the basis. The basis was that they had some psychologicals that they needed a psychologist. They already had a psychologist. They didn't need Dietrich to do those evaluations. Dr. Campion had been doing those evaluations for 15 years. There was no emergency. There's no way that you could even consider that emergency. And
if you would like to just wrap up and give you a minute to just a bit
yes.
to do that.
So based on the totality of all those circumstances, the timing, the statements by McNeil, the fact that the other aldermen went along with what they knew was the reason and didn't say anything about it, four of the aldermen said that they did it because the mayor recommended it, and that's how they handle these things with psychologicals.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Realm. The court will take the case under advisement.